This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I'm pretty sure it was a joke, but I saw Cypress up for sale on eBay today. 1,251 euros was the highest bid, proving, I suppose, the desperate times do call for desperate measures. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 21st of March. Glad you could be with us. And we may, I stress may here, be nearing the end game of this whole Cyprus thing. Today, the European Union said, in basically this many words, you got till Monday to take the bailout, or else. The else being financial ruin, banking collapse, and quite possibly getting the boot from the EU. So, desperate, yes. Time for Plan B and C and maybe even D. Yeah, I'd say so. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark gets us going today.
As my writer friend once told me, deadlines can be a muse for creativity. And that seems to be happening in Cyprus. Lots of creative ideas of where to find the $5 billion or so that would get the country on better footing. The Archbishop of Cyprus is rummaging under the cushions, saying the church is ready to offer its assets.
The entire wealth of the church is at the disposal of the country to support the people of Cyprus so that the banking system does not collapse.
Or maybe the money could come from under the earth. There's been a proposal to fast-track offshore natural gas exploration to raise funds, and that might attract more investment from Russia.
Right, they're really scraping the barrel.
Desmond Lockman is a global economist with the American Enterprise Institute.
They were thinking of raiding, you know, their pension fund.
And here's another just-so-crazy-it-might-work-but-probably-won't idea from Matt Iglesias. He writes about economics for Slate. Maybe you've heard of the ongoing conflict between Cyprus and Turkey. For decades, Turkey has claimed a chunk of the island, but no one has recognized that internationally.
My thought was that Cyprus could sell diplomatic recognition to Turkey and get some of the money they need.
It's happened before, Iglesias says. The Republic of Genoa sold the island of Corsica to France to cover some bad debts back in the 1700s. And Iglesias says there are always corporate naming rights.
You know, it could be U.S. Airways Island or any number of things.
We'll make that Plan Z. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
On page A1 of the New York Times today, we were reminded that the lineage of The Tonight Show goes Johnny Carson. Yes, there were people before him, but Johnny Carson, Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien, Jay Leno again, and now perhaps Jimmy Fallon. NBC is apparently going to move the show back to New York and install Fallon as the host sometime next year. It's not about the ratings, exactly, at least not on television, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
It's The Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
The Tonight Show may be old school, but it still pulls in more than 3 million viewers a night. Those eyeballs are what advertisers care about, says Bill Carroll with Katz Television Group. But he says they're starting to pay attention to Twitter, YouTube, and other social media.
It's becoming part of the overall equation.
Nielsen released a report yesterday that found Twitter has a major impact on TV ratings. Good news for Jimmy Fallon, who has more than 8 million Twitter followers. Jay Leno has just 500,000.
The social audience is becoming just as important as the traditional TV audience.
William Ward is a social media professor at Syracuse University. He says when Charlie Sheen quit the hit show Two and a Half Men, it was no coincidence that his replacement, Ashton Kutcher, had more than 6 million Twitter followers.
that was one of the reasons he was cast for that show, is that he could bring an audience over.
In the future, the audience that determines TV ad rates could include a show's Twitter followers and YouTube clips. A dance Fallon performed with Michelle Obama on his show last month has gone viral on YouTube with more than 15 million views. And finding the right host for The Tonight Show is all about the future of media, says analyst Brad Adgate.
Leno has sat at the desk for 20 years, so you have to look somewhere 5-10 years down the road, and how are people going to be consuming content, particularly younger ones?
In other words, the future of The Tonight Show is the video clips people are going to watch tomorrow morning. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
As Stacey alluded to, when we do watch those video clips online, it's increasingly on YouTube. The company said today it's got 1 billion monthly users. That's half of everybody on the internet. But 1 billion users does not a profitable business make, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Most of YouTube's best videos have ads. So before you can watch LeBron do the Harlem Shake with the rest of the Miami Heat, you gotta listen to a pitch for Formula One racing.
On the NBC Sports Network.
Con los terroristas!
But those ads and all that Harlem shaking might not add up to big bucks for YouTube and Google, which owns it. Brian Weiser is an analyst at Pivotal Research.
The question about how much money they make, or frankly, how much money they lose, is still an open question.
As for the billion user mark, he says, when it comes to making money,
it's not terribly meaningful.
It's a recurring theme in these tech stories. Internet users do not equal profit. Bernard Gershon is president of Gershon Media.
In the press release yesterday, they said if YouTube were a country, we'd be the third largest in the world after China and India. And I would argue or ask the question, if YouTube were a standalone business, would it be bankrupt?
Most YouTube videos don't have ads. Most advertisers don't want to go near them.
I think that premium advertisers and Fortune 500 brands want to be associated with premium quality, high quality video.
Not singing squirrels. Gershon expects YouTube will keep adding eyeballs. But to make money, he says, it's going to need to add more widely appealing content. And it's considering a subscription service where we have to pay to watch the really good stuff. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it simply was not to be. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a cattle rancher out in Rolla, Missouri that we've been talking to the past couple of months. Ken Lennox is his name. He's been working the land out there for a good 40 years or more, probably. And he told us that last summer's drought was the worst he'd ever seen. So we've called him back up today to see what spring has brought. Mr. Lennox, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Yes, sir. It's good to talk to you.
So do me a favor. Look out your window. Tell me what you see. I'm hoping it's some kind of rolling green pasture.
We have green grass, and it's beautiful to look at, but that's about all the good it does. It's not grown enough yet. We had 20 degrees this morning, and it's not going to grow in 20-degree weather.
Seems to me you can't catch a break. You got drought, you got frost. What are you going to do?
Well, the calendar says it's spring. It just hasn't sprung here yet. We're right on the verge of grass growing, though. I got the fertilizer on. We've had the moisture.
Uh-huh.
The moisture is good. We're running on 7-8 inches already this year, and it's kind of on the sweet spot. Not too much, not too little.
How are the cows, or cattle, I guess you call them?
Oh, they're doing great. The cattle have come through in great shape. We're working one herd after another right now. We've got to give them their shots and get them ready for sale time in June. Mm-hmm. So we've been busy.
Is there a way for you to count, as we sit here talking, how much this drought has cost you from the dry spell to today?
It was probably a little over $100,000, I'd say.
It's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money, yes. Normally I can get through the winter for 500 bales of hay,
mm-hmm.
and it took several times that. And if you figure $50, $60 a bale, which is what they were costing, you know. It's running right now, even today, it's running over $1,000 a day to feed hay.
Wow.
And as soon as the grass gets here, that stops. So, yeah, I want grass.
I bet you do. That money's gone, right? You're not going to make that back on the sale of these cattle, however heavy they get.
No, that money's gone. You're exactly right.
So are you set for the spring now? I mean, you just got to wait for the grass to grow and everything's going to be okay then. I mean, you're feeling more relaxed?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. My wife and I, we feel good about it. We had the grandkids here for a week in their summer break. So we've had some good times this winter.
Well, good. Good, good. Ken Lennox. He's our cattle rancher out in Rolla, Missouri. Mr. Lennox, thanks a lot for your time.
Could I say hello to friends of mine out in Oilmont, Montana? I'm going to their bull sale.
Now, why do you have to go to Montana to buy bulls?
Well, it'll be in Antioch, Nebraska.
Oh.
But they're good friends of mine, and they have good cattle. And their name's Tom Shack, and I'd just like to say hi to them.
Yeah, of course. Now, what do? You have to probably load them in a truck and get them back to Missouri, right?
Well, they deliver. I wouldn't be going if I had to drag my trailer that far.
All right, Mr. Lennox. Have a good day, sir.
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye-bye now. In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania today, the buzz is fracking. A high-profile environmental pollution case linked to it was settled a while ago, and the details are just now coming out, as Marketplace's Scott Tong tells us from the Sustainability Desk.
In the fracking wars, the secret settlement between driller Range Resources and the Hallowitz family outside Pittsburgh is a defining battle. Now that the case is public, many are underwhelmed. Company paid $750,000, admitting no fault. The family argued that a well or a wastewater pit poisoned their water, but they took the deal and they moved out. Hallowitz family friend Bob Donnan.
You do what you have to for your family. If you have to sign a gag or if you have to take a number that basically just gets you into another house, you do it.
Papers do indicate the Hallowitz's drinking water contained a chemical linked to cancer, acrylonitrile, 30 times the safe level. Environmental chemist Wilma Subra.
It is a carcinogen, a known human cancer-causing agent, and can cause things like lung cancer. The animal studies have indicated that acrylonitrile causes brain and stomach cancer.
Acrylonitrile has been used in fracking. Still, defendant Range Resources says the documents all show that fracking is safe. And while plaintiffs also slam the regulators for being asleep, Pennsylvania's Environment Secretary Michael Crancer says the rules are enforced.
It definitely works well, and I think when you're told that by folks, you need to dig down and find out exactly what they're talking about and ask them to show you specifics.
The drama isn't over. Key settlement documents are still missing from the file, stoking rumors of funny business. And resident Bob Donnan argues the misdeeds are continuing. He says the suspicious wastewater pit by the Hallowitz family was mysteriously emptied, evidence destroyed.
One of the valves was opened up, and the water was just allowed to dump on the ground, and that was in the Agape Bible Camp.
Which leaves everyone where they started. Critics still suspicious, and industry declaring itself clean. In Pittsburgh, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, Super Bowl, Schmooper Bowl.
The NCAA tournament was worth 35% more to the networks last year. They took in $1 billion in revenue, which makes March Madness the most valuable postseason sports franchise on TV.
Ah, Stephen Dubner. Freakonomics, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. A new season, but the Wall Street, I don't know what that is, had no spring in its step. The Dow Industrial sagged 90 points today, 0.6%, closed at 14,421. The NASDAQ off 31 points, a tad under 1%, finished at 3,222. The S&P 500 gave back 12 points, 0.8%, ended things at 1,545. Oracle plummeted more than 9.5%. That a day after the software giant reported disappointing earnings. That pulled down other tech stocks along with it. Cisco Systems fell 3.8%. Shares of fellow blue chip Intel slipped 0.2%. But just to be contrary, as it has been these days, working at home, anyone? Yahoo picked up 3.5% on an upgrade from a Wall Street analyst. Tough times for publishers, as you might have heard. Scholastic felt the pain today. Shares sank nearly 14% after reporting a bigger-than-expected loss. Financial shares bled red. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley each debited 3% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.91%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its monthly report on mass layoffs. That's when 50 or more workers from one employer lose their jobs. Tomorrow is World Water Day, the United Nations theme this year, water cooperation. And it's the anniversary of the first Stanley Cup championship game. On March 22, 1894, Montreal defeated Ottawa to claim the trophy. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. A Russian lawyer goes on trial tomorrow in Moscow. It's a tax case. Worth a mention here for two reasons. One, the man is almost certainly innocent. And number two, he's dead. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports on the case of Sergei Magnitsky.
Trying a dead man will be a first for Russia's legal system, but Magnitsky's former law partner, Jameson Firestone, says it's not a precedent of which the Russians should be proud.
The reason you have a trial is to have somebody, a defendant gets the chance to defend themselves, and dead people can't defend themselves, which is why we don't try dead people in the civilized world.
Magnitsky goes on trial more than 3 years after his death in a Russian jail. A Russian human rights group says he was beaten and tortured, which the authorities deny. But Jameson Firestone insists his colleague had been arrested and then murdered in prison for exposing a $230 million tax fraud by Russian officials.
The government knows that its officials were involved in stealing public funds, and the government went on to protect all of those officials and to arrest and kill the whistleblower.
But why, 3 years later, put the dead whistleblower in the dock and try him for the very offences he exposed?
A dead man is being put on trial in order to build a counter-narrative to explain away how Magnitsky died and how Russian taxpayers have lost $230 million.
Nick Redman of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He says the key to this macabre case lies in the US Congress. Last year it passed the Magnitsky Act. That slapped an asset freeze and a travel ban on 60 Russian officials implicated in Magnitsky's death. And that's really rankled Russia's ruling classes.
It's been regarded as a huge insult in Russia. For the US, the arm of the US law to be reaching into Russia is, of course, very deeply and bitterly resented.
And he says there's real fear the Europeans might follow suit.
There are far more assets and far more money stashed away in Europe. So if EU states were to adopt similar legislation, it would be extremely disruptive for the people that run Russia.
The man at the heart of this drama is Bill Browder. He was once the biggest Western investor in Russia. His companies were hijacked and used in the $230 million tax fraud. He hired Magnitsky and Firestone to investigate. He's not surprised by tomorrow's trial. He says nothing's changed. It's business as usual for Russia's kleptocrats.
The theft of assets, the false criminal cases, the pressuring of witnesses, the involvement of crooked law enforcement officers and shakedowns, that happens every day to every foreign business in Russia.
As Russia proceeds to put a dead man in the dock, the mayor of London, Boris Johnson, has proposed a rather different memorial, to name a building after Magnitsky in honour of the dead lawyer and his campaign against corruption. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio.
Aw,
That Moment every couple of weeks. We talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is, yes, it is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, good to have you back.
Hey, Kai, great to be back. Are you a big college basketball fan?
Medium-ish. I tune in for the tournament.
Okay, so the tournament is just underway. That's March Madness.
Yep.
NCAA basketball tournament, for those who don't know, runs 3 weeks, and every single game now is televised on either CBS or one of the Turner networks. It's remarkably popular, millions and millions of viewers. So I thought it might be fun to just see how good these networks are at turning those millions of viewers into dollars.
And how good are they?
Well, before we even get into the actual money, the one striking thing is ownership. So CBS and Turner have locked up March Madness in a 14-year contract, which is in direct contrast to that other marquee sporting event, which is the Super Bowl. That rotates each year between one of three networks.
Which is to say the Super Bowl is year-to-year business. March Madness is a steady income, right? It's a recurring business, yeah.
You got it. So here's the thing. If I'm one of the three Super Bowl networks, that's CBS, NBC, or Fox, I actually have to root for my rivals during the off years because I want them to drive the price up, because whatever price increase they perform, I then inherit it and get to build on it the following year.
Right, for the ad rates, right?
Exactly.
All right, so can we then infer that the Super Bowl is more profitable than March Madness?
That was the inference I was interested in finding out. And the truth is it's really hard to tell. So it depends how you measure it. The Super Bowl ad rates have increased more quickly, more steadily than the NCAA championship game ad rates. But March Madness has done a few other things. They have increased the number of games they show to the point where last year, year over year alone, the NCAA tournament was worth 35% more to the networks last year. They took in $1 billion in revenue, which as of now makes March Madness the most valuable postseason sports franchise on TV.
Well, yeah, but you know and I know, Mr. Dubner, that revenues do not equal profits, my friend.
That is exactly right. And these networks, whether it's the Super Bowl or March Madness, they pay a lot of money for the rights to broadcast, and they pay a lot of production costs. 2 years ago, CBS and Turner paid more for the rights to broadcast than they took in total ad revenue.
Oops.
So it's quite possible to lose money. On the other hand, as you know, loss leaders can be nice for a business like a TV network.
So where are we? Are we feeling sorry for them? That's not what you're saying, is it?
It's not for me to say whether you should feel sorry for the network. I will say this, from an economic standpoint, it does seem that they're leaving money on the table, however.
How so?
Well, you know, the way ads are sold on TV is still pretty old-fashioned. Yeah. Somebody will set a price. There's a little bit of negotiation. So we thought we could apply a little Freakonomics here and maybe offer some solutions. We talked to Jeff Ely. He's an economist at Northwestern University. He thought it might behoove the networks to think about auctioning off these ad slots.
Economists like auctions because they are kind of the ideal mechanism for finding out how much people are willing to pay for things, and at the same time, getting them to pay that much.
All right. Well, so does that shake things up then?
Well, yeah, might shake things up. Hard to say for better or worse. If you really want to shake things up, Jeff Ely has another idea. You know, Kai, how every year you hear about the Super Bowl ads that get rejected for one reason or another?
Oh, yeah. So like PETA had one at some point, right?
And here's the thing. We remember that, and they didn't have to pay for that ad to air. As Jeff Ely points out, it's great publicity. They don't have to pay the $4 million. So here's his idea.
I would charge a huge fee to even submit an ad for consideration for the Super Bowl. Everyone who was accepted would have that fee reimbursed and then charge just the advertising rate of having their advertisement aired. And everyone who was rejected would not get their fee reimbursed. And effectively what I would be doing would be charging for the right to have your advertisement rejected.
but the Super Bowl is like the biggest sporting event on the planet, right? And March Madness, while big, is not that.
It is a different – there are plainly differences between the two. It's a different event, as you said. They appeal to different constituencies. Also, let me point out one other huge difference that doesn't get discussed very much between March Madness and the Super Bowl, which is the amount of money, of all that money, that goes to the actual talent. So in the NFL, the average player salary is roughly $2 million a year. That's average. In the NCAA, again, these are amateur college athletes, the average salary is exactly $0 and 0 cents. So one thing we do know for sure is where those hundreds of millions of ad dollars are not going, and that is to the athletes themselves.
Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks, man.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
All right, see ya.
Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace is co-produced by WNYC and is supported by Reputation.com, helping professionals and businesses look their best when people search for them online. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which, sadly, Marketplace is getting its rear end kicked. I can't believe it, but it's true. KPCC here in Los Angeles has put together a public radio playoff bracket. We are in the second round today, and we are losing to a program I don't think I can bring myself to say the name of. The host of that other program, Peter Sagal, joins me now. Peter.
Kai.
I wonder, sir, how you account for this. Could it be your veteran Carl Castle helping you out?
I'm just saying, I got backup.
I
have
pal.
The castle. Who do you got? You got Robert Reich? Oh, yeah, he's 4.5 feet
hey,
tall.
Hey.
Carl is 6'1 and pretty intimidating.
No spring chicken, my friend.
Fine. He was dominating public radio when you were in short pants, my little friend.
I think what we have here is youthful energy and dynamism versus some old guy and his short, bald sidekick.
And you have a daily stock ticker.
What are you going to do? Are you going to haul out the panel next, Paula and Mo and the gang, to help you out?
There's no need. Do you think that we need the amazing array of talents we bring to public radio every week to take you guys on?
We do it every day, pal. We do it every day.
You know what they said
to
the Lion when they said...
Give me a week to do a show. I could do anything.
I understand. That's a standard excuse. Sure, use it. You know what they said to the lion? They said, oh, the lion only has one cub at once, while we lesser animals have litters. And the lion said, yes, but it is a lion.
I have no idea what that means. What does that even mean?
Really, it's all a parable. Jeez.
Peter Sagal. Wait, don't tell me. Peter, thanks.
My pleasure.
Yes, it's all in good fun, but we still want to win. We've got a link to that KPCC bracket on our website, marketplace.org. And you got to go. Got to do the right thing, right? You got to vote for us. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 90 points, 0.6%, 14,421. The NASDAQ off 31 points, a tad under 1%. The S&P 500 gave back 12 points, 0.8%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karpeth, and Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, but not before you go to that link on our page and vote for us in the bracket. I'm dead serious about this, people, all right? Come on. My voice, your home answering machine. We can make that work. Please. Vote for us. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.